Thank you for coming back tonight. For those of you visiting with us tonight, maybe for the first time during this series, I'm calling the group my class because this is a lecture. And we began this series of lectures last night with an introductory lesson designed to help lay the groundwork for all that we're going to be doing tonight and tomorrow night. I'm sorry you missed it if you were not here. They have taped all of this. They've recorded it, so you're welcome to go back and listen. I don't have time to teach that lesson again. So, with the introduction laid, and everybody that was here last night remembers every word I said, I'm sure. Have no doubt about that. No, I have lots of doubt about that. But hopefully you got the basic fundamental points as to why this is important, and what are some of the groundwork principles upon which we're building it. Welcome back, those of you that have been here, and welcome if you're a visitor with us tonight. We think this lesson will stand alone as well, so we'll bid you to give us your very careful attention. You can see the theme this evening is design at the microscopic level. What we're going to be doing this evening is looking at the evidence of the natural world at the microscopic level and then asking you the question, which is more reasonable? Did this come about by natural causes, or is it more reasonable that this was intelligently designed? All right, I want to begin this evening, since we're doing this series in a church building, by referring to the Bible. Please turn to Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. It's the theme verse from the Bible for this series. I will say again this evening, for those of you who were not here last night, it is not necessary for me to refer to the Bible to use the evidence I'm going to use this evening. I'm going to refer to God's other book, the book of the natural world. I'm starting with the Bible this evening because we're in a church building. If this were being done in a lecture hall at a college, I wouldn't use the Bible at all. Instead, we would turn our attention to the evidence of the natural world. The reason I take that approach is because a number of folks through the years with whom I've had to do were not believers in God. It is of no value to quote Scripture to a person who isn't a Bible believer or even a God believer. It's better to start with evidence that that person will at least be willing to examine with you. And that's the evidence of the natural world. Another reason I refer to this passage this evening is because it sets the stage for all of you in this audience who do believe the Bible is the Word of God, as do I, by the way, that the Bible itself supports this approach. So look with me again at Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Here's what this passage says. You can see God even though He's invisible. How do you do that? By examining the things that are made. Things that are made give testimony to a maker. And this passage says the things you can determine about God from examining the things that are made, that is the natural world, are His eternal power and His divinity. Whoever created this must have been very powerful. And something separate from the natural world. Those things you can determine by examining the natural world, says this passage. So I'm saying to you again, Bible believers, that the Bible itself supports the approach I'm going to take for the next hour. And that is to turn our attention to the things that are made. And I will not make further reference to this book during that series of discussions we'll have. We're going to turn now to God's other book. So here we go. We're going to look at the argument from design. design argues for a designer. And I'm here to tell you tonight, there is design at the microscopic level in this world. Tomorrow night, we're going to talk about design at the macroscopic level. And the bottom line is, everywhere you look in the natural world is evidence for design. All of that argues for a grand designer. I referred last night to the SETI organization, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I did that for a very pointed reason. This group is searching for intelligent life somewhere else in the universe. And they're doing it on the basis of examining certain kinds of features of the natural world, from which they conclude there's got to be intelligence out there. And that's the same kind of reasoning I'm going to be using throughout these two lessons. So that's why I like to start with them. In their first paragraph on their website, they make the following observation. SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is an exploratory science that seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. So what are they looking for out there in outer space? They're trying to find a signature of technology. And here's what they're looking for. Let's see if I have that slide in here. They're looking for messages, radio signals from outer space. And they're hoping that in those radio signals, they will find information. Something that we can decode and understand. And if they were to find that, there would be great evidence in their mind that somebody intelligent out there is trying to communicate with us. So, for example, if we were to receive a message from space with a language in it that we could decode and read, that would be powerful evidence for intelligent life in the universe. And I think I'd agree with that. I don't know how you feel about that, but if we really did receive such a signal, that would be pretty powerful evidence, because nature doesn't produce languages by itself. That takes intelligence. And I would argue then, why do we have to look out there? Why not look right here on Earth? There are signs of intelligent design everywhere you look. In fact, every living cell is full of signs of intelligent design, and that's what I want to examine with you this evening. Okay, this thing quit working on me. Why is that? Can you help me? I must have done something. Wait, you think it ran out of juice? I have a way of breaking everything, so that's why we need techie guys. In the meantime, we'll do it the old-fashioned way. See there? These always work. Inside every living cell, ladies and gentlemen, there is a language. And we've learned how to decode and read it. We know exactly what it's saying. Every living cell has one in it. I quoted last evening from Professor Anthony Flew, who was an atheist, author, and debater from the past. Used to debate creationists like me, and was highly critical of my view. In recent days, he's made this statement. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. What Professor Flew, the former atheist, now says is that the evidence at the microscopic level inside of cells, the DNA evidence, is overwhelming evidence for a designer to him. That's what I want to talk to you about tonight. Now, it's going to take a little chemistry class. Are you ready? And I said last night, I'm going to say it again, I do not allow sleeping in my class. So if you start dozing off, we're going to stand up. Did we stand up last night, class? Yes, we did. Because some of you were fading out on me. I don't allow it. And you can't hide. I can see you. Research on DNA continues to reveal signs of design at the microscopic level. It's amazing. And so much has been uncovered, even in the last 10 years. that we never knew before. You live in one of the most exciting times in the history of mankind. We have learned more about life at the biochemical level in the last 60 years than in all the rest of the history of mankind put together. And you lived through it. It's amazing. I hope you're excited about it. I want to say something else right here to the youngsters in this audience. Don't you be afraid of science, children. When I was your age, I really believed that if I dug too deeply into science, I would lose my faith in God. I want to tell you, after 50 years of digging very deeply into science, I'm a stronger believer than I have ever been in my whole life. You don't need to be afraid of the sciences. You dig in there and learn. Anthony Flew said, I had to go where the evidence leads. I wish everybody were that honest. Here was a man who for 80 years was an atheist, and then he changed his mind about that based on the evidence of the natural world. I love a man like that. I hope I'm open-minded enough that maybe I might change my mind about something. I'd love it if some folks who studied the Bible might be that way too. You ever been wrong about a Bible passage? Some folks I know have never been wrong about anything about that. And they're probably wrong about that. So, here's a book I want to recommend to you. I'm bringing books each evening to introduce to you because we're just barely touching the veritable hem of the garment. This book's signature in the cell I brought so you could see how nice and thick it is. This is by Stephen Meyer. I think he's one of the best writers of our time on scientific subjects. He's outstanding. In this book, he discusses for you the history of this whole matter of the DNA. And there's a lot of history in it, not just science. So if you like history, you're going to love this book also. There's philosophy. There's mathematics. There's a lot of chemistry. It's an outstanding treatise on the subject I'm going to discuss with you tonight. Now, while I'm here, I want to show you his other classic work, Stephen Meyer, Darwin's Doubt. I'd highly recommend that to you as a secondary book, a next one after that one. It treats the great Cambrian explosion in the fossil record, which speaks to the origin of first life. I think these are his two companion documents. Excuse me, that really define his writing in our time. Both worth your reading. While I'm here, What Darwin Didn't Know by Jeffrey Simmons, medical doctor. What Darwin Didn't Know. This treats every group of the human body, every part of our human body, and shows you things that we know about it now that Darwin knew nothing about. And his treatise is, if Darwin had known this, he never would have come up with his theory. Because it's beyond belief that these things evolved. Highly recommend What Darwin Didn't Know. And then Darwin's Black Box, another excellent treatise on the complexity of living things. Darwin's Black Box. Highly recommend to you. So I'm going to refer to some of these this evening, but I wanted to be sure you were at least introduced to them. All right. Here's what we're going to do this evening, class. I'm going to show you some evidence, facts of nature that we've discovered about life at the microscopic level. Don't argue with facts. You always lose. And then I'm going to ask you the question, looking at the evidence, which is more reasonable, natural causes or intelligent design? Which is more reasonable? And you're going to answer that question. You'll be the jury and the judge. So I'm going to be like a lawyer here this evening. And I make no pretense that I'm not biased. I'm biased. I'm going to try to convince you of the intelligent design viewpoint. You hear this one all the time in public media and television and all your classes at school. I'm going to present this side. You study them both. May I say to you, class, don't accept something because I said it. You go look for yourself. And that's a very good rule of thumb, no matter who you're listening to. I'm going to try to present to you a case for intelligent design. But I'm also going to try to show you what the folks say who believe that natural things cause this. so you can have some basis for judgment. So here we go. We're ready now for our chemistry lesson. So I'm going to take this little book that I brought called Life, Its Origin and Nature by Dr. Francis Crick. If you're a biology student, you should very well know who Dr. Crick is. Dr. Francis Crick and Dr. James Watson received the Nobel Prize in 1953 for discovering the structure of DNA. 1953, class. That was a huge breakthrough year in the history of mankind. Because once the structure of DNA was uncovered, it was like a whole new world was opened up to us. And ever since then, we've been learning more and more and more about that marvelous structure. Dr. Francis Crick got us started on that journey. So I'm going to be quoting some from his little book, Life Itself. What is life like as we know it here on Earth? Well, you can see before you on the screen, which is actually a quote from page 72 of this little book. Life as we know it on Earth appears as a synthesis of two macromolecular systems. Well, I just lost you. It's a putting together of two sets of huge molecules. Every living thing we know anything about has two classes of molecules. The proteins, because of their versatility and chemical reactivity, do all the work. But they are unable to reproduce themselves in any simple way. So let me pause just a moment. I told you last night, when I say something, I'm saying something important. And especially if I pause and say it again. Proteins do a lot of the work in the living things, but they can't reproduce themselves. So that's one large class of molecules. Here he describes it. There are structural materials that are proteins that make up the shape and mobility of living things. Proteins. But there's another kind of proteins that's the tools and machinery. They're called enzymes. They are special forms of proteins. And they take care of the metabolism, the growth and maintenance of living things. Both of those operations in living things are managed by proteins. But that's not enough. You can't have living things with just proteins. So he goes on. The nucleic acids, the RNA and the DNA, are tailor-made for reproduction, but can achieve rather little else compared with the more elaborate and better equipped proteins. So the blueprints, ladies and gentlemen, the RNA and the DNA allow for reproduction, but they can't do much else. And every living thing has both. You can't have a living thing without both. Now, he will say things like this. Life as we know it has these two big classes of molecules. May I say to you, class, there isn't any other life that anybody knows anything about. So when you say life as we know it, would you please understand that means our life here on Earth. Oh, I can read you books where they make up stories about how their life forms might exist, but nobody has ever found one, and nobody knows anything about any other life form. We are it. And our life forms are made up of proteins and nucleic acids in every single one of them. It's required. And by the way, they are water-based and carbon-based, period, living things. Well, Dr. Crick goes on to say in this little treatise, the problem of the origin of life would be a great deal easier to approach if there were only one family of large molecules capable of doing both jobs, reproduction and all the work. But life as we know it employs two families. So a major question for an evolutionist is, how did life get started in the first place? From non-living things. When it requires these two large families of molecules working together in perfect concert to make a living thing. How'd that happen? It's a big problem. And I can tell you, young people, when I was in high school and college, we were just uncovering some of these secrets about DNA and proteins and all that stuff. And my professors would say to me, you folks in this class who believe in God better get over it. Because we're uncovering so much of the secrets of life, it's not going to be 50 years until we know exactly how life functions in all its capacities, and we'll be able to produce life without any God. And may I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that scared me. But I will tell you this, 50 years later, we know less about how life got started without God than we knew 50 years ago, because we've found out it is 10,000 million times more complicated. We're not better off in explaining how life originated. We're worse off from an evolutionary standpoint. And the more we learn, the worse it gets for the evolutionary view. I do have to tell you that he goes on in this little book to speak to how challenging it is. But then he says it may have happened easily. But then he says, it may not have been enough time on this earth in 3.5 billion years to form the first life. And he spends the rest of this book showing how it might have been sent here on a spaceship. This is a Nobel Prize winner, ladies and gentlemen. There's a book in here describing what the spaceship might have been like. I mean, a chapter in here. Do we know one thing about whether there has been directed panspermia, which is what he calls it? Somebody from out there sent a spaceship with some simple life forms here to get it started. That is called directed panspermia. That's a fancy name for we don't have a clue. And this Nobel laureate spends half the book talking about that mess. And here's what I say about that. Anything but God. Even something for which there's not one scintilla of evidence. But it is a fact, class, that every living thing we know anything about has these two great classes of molecules in it, functioning. As I said, there are two types of proteins, structural and enzyme, and they are the workhorses of living things. So I'm going to spend an inordinately small amount of time talking to you about proteins. So I offer my apology to every protein for the paltry, insufficient job I'm going to do. We should spend at least 2 years talking about proteins and nothing else. You're going to get a crash course in proteins. It's just enough to get me to the subject of DNA, which is where I want to be tonight. So here you have before you, class, the 20 common amino acids that occur in proteins in all living things. Did you know that? From single-celled organisms to elephants, we all have the same chemistry. Those 20 proteins, amino acids, we call them. They're not proteins, they're amino acids. Are the building blocks for proteins in every living thing. So I want you to take just a moment, because if you were in my class, you would memorize this. You'd memorize their names, their abbreviations, and their chemical structures. And we'd have a quiz tomorrow. And if you messed up on that, we'd have another quiz the next day. And I would keep quizzing you until you got it. Why is that? It's only the foundation for everything else we're going to do. These are critically important substances. Let me tell you just a little bit about them. Why are they called amino acids? Because if you'll notice, every one of them has an NH3 group. You see that? Every one of them has an NH3. That's called an amine. So they're called amino. They also all have a little COO group here. That's carbon and two oxygens. That's a organic acid. So they are amino acids, every one of them. So they have something in common, but every one of them is different. And you know why that's important, class? Because the chemistry of the amino acid determines how it's going to interact with other things. And every one of them is critically important for what it does. Sounds like a plan to me, as so many other things do. But it is the truth that these 20 occur in all proteins in all living things. Every protein is a combination of these 20. I want to add just a little slight exception there because I've had medical students correct me about this. There are a few proteins that have something else in them too, but hardly any. So it's not worth talking about. So that's over here. What I'm saying is 99.9% correct. It's very much like the 26 letters of the alphabet which make up our words. Every word in English is a combination of 26 letters, isn't it? A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, O, P, so on. You put those letters together in different sequences and you get different words. Proteins are strings of amino acids. All right, are you with me? Do something with your head so I know you're alive. Okay. Good. Now, I want you to be very clear that what I'm about to put on the screen was not said by me. It's a direct quote from Francis Crick's book on page 72. If you don't believe me, come up and look at it later. I didn't say this. He said the RNA and the DNA that are the nucleic acids, that other big class of molecules, are the dumb blondes of the biomolecular world, fit for reproduction and not much else. Sorry, blondes. I didn't say that. But the reason I like to put it up here on the screen is because that's probably the only thing you'll remember from what I said tonight. The RNA and the DNA are the dumb blondes of the biomolecular world. They're good for reproduction. So my job for the next few minutes is to show you how they reproduce. So here we go. Here's a picture of the DNA molecule that Francis Crick and James Watson discovered in 1953. And you can see it's a strand wrapped around another strand. You see that? It's interweaving strands. And do you notice they also have cross pieces here? So DNA has a certain characteristic structure. It's a double helix with crossbars. And because of that, it has the capacity to reproduce itself. That was the amazing discovery of the 1950s. And we have learned so much more about this in the last 60 years. But I'm going to deal only with the basics right now. So here is a strand of DNA. You see it here? What happens with the DNA is it unzips, comes apart. And when it does, it exposes two sides, this side and this side. And as it exposes that side, those cross pieces, you see these cross pieces right here? Those cross pieces are really made up of two chemicals that join like this. And they come apart. And when they come apart, both sides are exposed. Now, what we've learned is in DNA, there are exactly four substances that form those cross pieces. Exactly four. I'm going to name them for you. Adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. A, G, what did I say? G, A, C, G, and T. Four. And here's what you'll find. A, and let's see, where are we? A and T always hook up, and C and G always hook up. T and A work together, C and G work together. Like a horse in a carriage and love in marriage. A joins with T, G joins with C. When A is on this side, on the other side you get a U. Don't ask me about that. That's too much time to take. Sometimes it's T, sometimes it's U. But there are exactly four letters along this strand in various combinations, and then their exact complement is on this side. When we first started studying DNA many, many years ago in the 50s, everybody thought only one side of the DNA was copied. Now we know both sides are copied, and we know a whole lot more about it also. But let's focus on this side right here. If you were to start right here on this strand, I'm going to read it to you, okay? Everybody stay with me. The first three letters are C-A-T, cat. That's a word in English, isn't it? If you keep reading, the next three letters are C-A-G, that's cag. The next three letters are G-G-A. How do you say that? Gaga. Then it's T-T-G, that's T-T-G. This is not a language you speak, ladies and gentlemen. And here's what we've learned about the language in DNA. It's always three-letter words. They're only three-letter words. So it's four different letters taken three at a time. All right, let me say that one more time. There are four different letters taken three at a time. And you can repeat letters. So if we did a little math in here, class, I could ask you, how many words can be formed if you have four letters and you can only use three at a time with repeats? How many words could you make? Well, you'd have to know your combinations. The answer is there are exactly 64 words. It's 4 times 4 times 4. This is a language, ladies and gentlemen. We've learned how to read. That has exactly 64 words, all of which are three-letter words, and we know exactly what they mean. And my job's to show you. But as you read along this strand of the DNA, you're reading words. And each word means something. So look, if you start reading right there, and you read three-letter words all the way across till you get over here, you've got a strand of three-letter words. And they mean something. Now, before I leave this slide, notice. You see over here, we've got this blue strand here. That's a strand that's making a copy of what's on here. So every time you see a C over here, you get a G over here. Every time you get a G over here, you get a C over there. If you get a T over here, you get an A over here. If you get a T over here, you get an A over there. You see that? It's making the exact reflection copy. So when this strand is finished, you've got a copy of what's on here, and you can take it away and do something with it. Amazing. That's the first step in explaining to you how DNA allows you to reproduce yourself. Something else before I leave this slide. You see that glob right there? That's called RNA polymerase. If you see a word in biochemistry that ends in A-S-E, that means it's an enzyme. And if you were listening to me a while ago, you know that an enzyme is a protein. So that's a very specialized protein, and what it does is it rides along the DNA and allows it to unzip. So, ladies and gentlemen, it takes a glob of proteins to allow the DNA to unzip, which allows you to copy it, which allows you to reproduce. That's a simple way of saying it takes proteins to make DNA do its job. There you have before you, ladies and gentlemen, all 64 words in the genetic code, if you knew how to read it. So I'm going to show you how to read. Are you ready, first graders? We're going to learn how to read. So here we go. If the first letter is on this side, the second letter is across there, and the third letter is down this side, you can form all the three-letter words that there are. So let's take this as your first letter. That's a U. It's also the same as the T. So here's a U. First letter is U. Second letter is U. Third letter is U. That's the word you. Wonder how you pronounce that. But what does it mean? What does you mean? Here's what it means. Phenylalanine. That's very helpful, isn't it? Ooh means phenylalanine. Let's try another one. How about C-U-U? How would you pronounce C-U-U? Coo. What does that mean? C-U-U means leucine. And by doing what I've just done for you twice, you can read every three-letter word in all the 64. And what you will see here, class, is you will see the names of something. I wonder if anybody has any clue what those are the names of. Probably not. What you find up there on that screen, ladies and gentlemen, are all 20 amino acids that I showed you a while ago that you were supposed to have memorized. What's in the genetic code, ladies and gentlemen, is three-letter words that stand for the amino acids that go into every protein. So we have here a language that codes for every protein in the living body. Utterly amazing. How do you know when to start reading down that line? Well, there's a code for start reading. A-U-G means start reading. In addition to that, there are three codes for stop reading. So it tells you when to start reading, tells you when to stop reading, and in between you read three-letter words. Each of those three-letter words means an amino acid. So what's a string of amino acids, class? It's a protein. I wish I could have you answer out loud. Let's just pretend. Just mouth it. So what does the DNA code for? It codes for a string of amino acids, which makes a... Good. So class, what have I just shown you? You're the jury. I have shown you that in every living cell there is a language, and we know exactly what it means. It gives you the code for the amino acids with which you can then build proteins. And the body does that at an amazing rate of millions per second. What do you think, class, if SETI discovered from space a message that had the genetic code in it? What do you think they would say? Every newspaper on earth would say, we found a signal from an intelligent civilization. But you know what they say when we found this on earth in every living cell? Isn't it interesting how that evolved by natural causes? Nobody would say that if you got a signal from outer space with that in it. But with it in every living cell, we think, well, isn't it interesting how nature just did that? I don't believe that for one millisecond. Nature does not produce languages by itself. And that is precisely what you have. So, class, I would say my case rests. I could stop right here and I proved my case. There had to be a designer behind this. That's enough. But, folks, we haven't begun to start to begin to touch the veritable hem of the garment. There's so much more to this picture than what I've told you. All we've talked about is just the language in the DNA, basically, and how it is used to build proteins. I want to show you how this works now. So I'm going to be very brief about this part because we have a little video clip that's going to help you see it better. When you build proteins, you have to transcribe the information off of the DNA. You have to migrate outside the nucleus, and then you have to translate it inside the ribosomes over here, and out comes a protein out the bottom. It is a massively complex system. every piece of which requires a whole bunch of proteins because there's a lot of work involved. So let's blow this up a little bit, and let me just show you real quick. Here's the DNA inside the nucleus. It unzips, and if you were listening, it takes a protein to make it unzip, doesn't it? RNA polymerase. When it unzips, you make a copy. That copy is called the messenger RNA. It contains the information in the DNA inside the RNA, and then it's used somewhere else. What I'm not talking to you about is the ribosomal RNA and the transfer RNA, which is going on at the same time. That's another whole subject. We'll do that 2 weeks from now if you'll invite me back. All I'm focusing on is that piece right there. All right, notice that the messenger RNA, when it gets to this form, is immature. You see those white areas? Those are called introns. And what we've learned in more recent days is those are snipped out and reorganized so that you get the mature messenger RNA, which then migrates. Don't forget that. Introns right here. They're snipped out and reorganized. And then it migrates. Once it's outside the nucleus, you see it coming out of the nucleus here? It is picked up by two ducks hugging each other. No, that's not what that is. That's a ribosome. And it actually picks up that messenger RNA and reads it like a tape through a tape player. You see these three-letter words here I was telling you about? The messenger RNA brings that over here. It reads it, and it uses then stuff in the cytoplasm to build proteins out the bottom. Incredible. Now, what I'm going to do next is show you how that happens in 3D. Please, my techie guy, I'm counting on you. The book, Signature in the Cell, has a website. You can go to it later on your own, and there's a video clip on that website, which he is now going to show you. And I'm going to come down here. There is a moderator on the clip, but I'm better. So I will be the moderator. All right? And our expert techie guy is going to stop when I tell him to stop. And start when I tell him to start. So notice, we're starting here with a picture of a DNA molecule. You see that? And down inside, you remember there's four letters in a certain sequence joined by three-letter words, right? A bunch of three-letter words made out of four letters. That's what you see here in this double helix. So let's watch now as this process takes place. Here we go. There's those four letters, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, in a certain specific sequence. And in order to make that copy, what has to happen? The DNA has to unzip. Stop right there. You see that glob of protein? That's called RNA polymerase. Can you see the different colors? That's because it's a combination of several proteins, not just one. It's a glob of proteins that rides along the DNA and allows it to unzip, which allows it to be copied. I pause just a moment. Will you listen to me closely? Some of you are falling asleep. Watch it. I'm going to make you stand up. Question, class. If it takes the DNA to build proteins, right? And it takes proteins to unzip the DNA, then how'd you get the first protein? You see what I'm saying? You couldn't even unzip the DNA without a protein. But guess how you build that protein? From the DNA. But it takes the protein to make the DNA unzip, which you then can copy and then go build the protein. But what do you have to make that happen? The protein's in the first place! That's a big old problem for an evolutionist. It's like the chicken and the egg, isn't it? You got to have them both for it to function. Okay, so let's watch this happen now. Go ahead. There's that RNA polymerase riding along. Stop right there. This is more like what it looks like. Whoops, that's all right. You saw that glob before? That's kind of what it really looks like. And now you see the DNA unzipped. You see it? The glob is down here riding along this way, and the DNA unzips behind it. And by the way, can I pause again just a minute? You ever have trouble zipping up something? When you get something unzipped, is it sometimes hard to get it zipped back? Did you know the same thing happens with this? Class, there is another specialized protein that helps the DNA zip back up. And if it didn't, we'd be in a mess. Because DNA is unzipping all the time. But there's a specialized protein just to help it zip back together. Does that sound like a plan to you? It does to me. All right, now we have the unzipped DNA. And we're beginning to make our messenger RNA copies. Watch how this works. Here we go. You see the different pieces coming up and connecting on there? Stop right there. Do you remember that the chemical on this side exactly matches the chemical on that side? When there's an A over here, there's a T over here, and you remember that? So everything that comes up here has to match the one that's there. And then it forms a new strand called messenger RNA. Go right ahead. Here we go. You see how it's doing that? And it's copying the information is what it's doing. Now stop. You know the only problem with this video? It's way too slow. This thing happens much faster than what that's showing you. It happens in micromilliseconds. So they're going to try to speed this up a little bit to give you some idea of how fast this happens, but it's not going to work. It's not going to happen fast enough, but you wouldn't be able to see it. But go ahead. See, they're going to try to speed that up. Whoops, stop right there. All right, now, down inside this glob is where all that's taking place. And as the RNA is formed, it's released. You see it coming out here into the cytoplasm? It's being formed, and then it's released. Now, we should spend the next 2 weeks just talking about what little piece I just described to you. But we proceed. Go ahead. Okay, now it has released. Stop right there. It has released the messenger RNA that has all the information it copied from down inside there, and now we're migrating outside the nucleus. Okay, here we go. We're migrating. Go ahead. Now, you see these holes right here? Stop right there. That hole is a hole that leads from inside the nucleus to the outside of the nucleus. Now, do you think any respectable hole is going to let just anybody through the door? No, it is not. Not in a living cell. The nuclear cell wall has certain holes in it, but don't just let anything through there. And guess, class, what guards the hole? Say the word. Exactly. So you watch now. As this messenger RNA approaches that hole, let's see what happens. Here it comes. You see that little thing right there? That's a protein. As the messenger RNA approaches, he said, would you come on in? Stop right there. Just come right on in. That protein opens up and allows the messenger RNA through. If something else comes up there it doesn't open up. All right, so here we go. Messenger RNA passes through. And then guess what? When it's through, what do you think happens to that protein? It closes back up again. And stop. See on the other side right here, or that other side of the hole? Guess what's on that side? Another. You think an appropriate aperture in the nuclear membrane is going to let just anything go back in? No, beloved. Only what it wants. So far, I've pointed out at least 6 different proteins that are required to make this stuff happen. Every one of those proteins is coded in the DNA and has to be built this way. But they all have to be there so they can be built. Next slide. Keep going. All right, here we go. There's the messenger RNA, and now it's going to be picked up by the ribosomes. You see it comes in there, and the ribosomes close in on it. And now, stop right there. Here's the messenger RNA with the information. It's being passed through the ribosome, which is where all the work takes place to build the proteins. And it reads the information and translates it into a protein. Let's watch this happen. This is now down inside. Stop right there. Here's the messenger RNA, stop. Yeah, here's the messenger RNA. See the three-letter words? It's reading that three-letter word, and here's what it's saying. Go out there and get me an isoleucine. Guess what it takes, class, to go get that isoleucine? There are exactly 20 amino acids. There are exactly 20 proteins required because each one's specific for a specific amino acid. In addition to that, there's a transfer RNA that has to be used to make the thing come in there. You see these little weird-looking fellows right there? That's a transfer RNA that I'm not even talking about. It carries the amino acid inside and matches the code on top here so that you get the right one down here from the code up there. Class, biology teachers teach this stuff and are not in utter awe of what's happening here. What they do is brag on who's discovered this. What about the guy that made it in the first place? It's utterly incredible what's happening here. This code that came out of the DNA up there carries with it the information by which all of this is happening, and ultimately we get a string of amino acids here which makes a... Exactly right. Now, you know the problem with this? It's way too slow. So let's try and see if they can speed this up a little bit. Here comes the next transfer RNA with its amino acid. Can you see this? The amino acids are joining up here. They're forming polypeptide bonds, and each one of those is joining. Now let's get moving here. Come on, get going. Faster. Faster. Way faster. That is way too slow. Stop. Here's the messenger RNA being read through that ribosome, and out the bottom there, that little glob, that's the protein coming out. All right, keep going now. Here we go. The messenger RNA is being read. The protein's forming, and it's coming out the bottom. Do you see how it's turning and shaping around there? Stop right there. Whoops. See it? Here's what you need to know, class. The forming of that protein comes from a string of amino acids. That is not sufficient. Not only do you have to have a string of amino acids in a very specific order to get the protein you want, and every protein's order is unique, and your body has thousands of them, all of which are being built like this. But that's not enough. It's not just a string of amino acids. It's a string of amino acids, class, that shapes into a two-dimensional and then into a three-dimensional configuration, and every piece of it is critical. If the binary and tertiary structures aren't exactly what they need to be, it's not just enough to have that string. They've got to be shaped into a particular form, all of it critical to be able to function. Does this sound like a plan to you? Okay, so now it releases the protein into the cytoplasm, but that's not enough. You watch. It's going to be picked up by another organelle. Go ahead. See, it's picked up by this organelle here, and then inside this organelle, watch what happens. Now, this doesn't exactly look like this, but do you see how that's rotating all around and taking its particular shape and formation, three-dimensional? Until finally, it's in the exact configuration required for that particular protein. And it doesn't turn white. And after that is released into the cytoplasm to go do the job for which it was designed. And it's very interesting to me, class, that in biochemistry books, that's exactly how they say it. And then they say it wasn't designed. Nature just did all this. By natural causes, without any guidance from any designer whatsoever. So I ask you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, in the depths of your heart, can you honestly believe that what I've just described to you, that happens at a rate of thousands of molecules formed every second, you honestly believe that could happen by natural causes without any design whatsoever? You really believe that? If you do, I have a bridge I want to sell you. Down in the Everglades. Thank you. Was our guy good? He really was good. Thank you very much. There's the protein. I pause. You think I've told you everything going on inside DNA and inside the cell structure? I haven't even started. And it's all happening in microseconds at amazing ways, and it's all interacting. Nothing bumps into anything. It's amazing. And I'm going to skip this because we've already talked about it. The marvelous living cell makes over 200,000 molecules per second. You know how many billions of cells you have in your body? Every one of them made 200,000 molecules every second while you've been sitting there. And you wonder why you get tired just from sitting? Your cells are busy. So you better be getting your amino acids so you can build proteins so you can survive. Because cells are very busy places. But I want to close this lecture with this topic. And I want to do it this way. There will never be a time, class, when you're able to answer all questions. If you ever think that, you're dreaming. There will always be questions that challenge your faith, always. No matter what extent man's knowledge goes to. The uncovering of DNA and the massive complex structure inside every cell to me is a marvelous testimony of design. But as we uncovered more and more about the human genome, and all of you in this room have lived during the time when we started mapping the human genome, right? That happened in the 2000s. And you know, class, because it's been such a public thing, we now can map the human genome. It's very expensive. But we can look at every single piece of the DNA now. And I'll tell you what we've discovered. And this was only beginning to be uncovered in the late 1990s and on into the 2000s in any depth. I'll tell you what we discovered. A whole lot of that DNA sure looked like a bunch of junk. And we knew nothing about that before. It appears, class, that only about 5% of the entire DNA is used to do what I just described to you. Some people say 2%. What about the other 95%? And so when I was giving this series of lectures on the campus of the University of South Florida some years ago and was not well acquainted with some of the recent discoveries, I had a professor stand up in the question-answer session and say to me, "Now, Dr. Payne, you've told the class here about all the wonderful mechanisms involved in protein formation. What you didn't tell the class was that only takes about 5% of the entire DNA structure. And the rest of the 95% sure looks like a bunch of junk. And the God that you're trying to talk about, do you think he would have made something that's 95% junk? Maybe you ought to tell the class about that." "No, class," he said, "most of the DNA looks like the leftovers of its evolutionary past because it's got a bunch of leftover junk, and most of it's not doing anything except taking up space." Well, I ask you, believers in God, is it reasonable to believe if God created DNA that he'd create it 95% junk? I don't think so. That would be a challenge for me. And I have to tell you, there was an extended period of time for me, and I've been studying this stuff a long time, where it was greatly bothersome to me that people would say, you've got a thing that's 95% junk. And it sure looked like it. Because there were whole vast stretches of DNA that looked like deserts of repetitive nonsense. Then there were pieces in it that look like, I'll give you one classic example, they call them pseudogenes. The human genome has a pseudogene in it for vitamin C. That same gene in rabbits builds vitamin C. It works just fine. But in humans, we don't make vitamin C. You have to take vitamin C because your body doesn't produce it. But in rabbits, it does. You know what the evolutionist says about that class? As we evolved from common ancestors with rabbits, our genome was mutated to the point that its DNA doesn't work anymore for vitamin C. Rabbits went on this branch and theirs still works. Folks, listen to me. That is not a stupid explanation. That's one possible explanation for that phenomenon. Pseudogenes are the result of mutations, they say. Do we know mutations happen? Yes, they do. Do you know they can leave leftover junk? Yes, they can. So the evolutionists would say to you, don't talk to me about how DNA is such a marvelous example of design. It's a marvelous example of evolution because it's full of junk. And you know what I almost want to do when I do these lectures? I almost want to stop right there and leave you going crazy over that. Because there will always be something like that. Always. That you don't know the answer to. But may I give you a few words of comfort? In 50 years of my experience, here's what I've found. When there's something that sure looks like it's contradictory to my convictions that there was a designer, and it sure looks like there's a bunch of junk there that maybe is better evidence for a non-design, if I give it about 15 or 20 years, things become clearer many times. Did you know that in the 1800s, the common theory was that your body is a veritable body of leftover junk? You've got a bunch of vestigial organs that are leftovers from your evolutionary past. At one time, that number was 156 leftover vestigial organs that you no longer use, but you did use in your evolutionary past. You know what that number's down to in our time? Depends on who you talk to. Zero in the minds of some. Some say the muscles in your outer ears or the tailbone, your coccyx, maybe your appendix. But I'll tell you, we've learned the appendix is pretty critically important for lots of things. They used to think it was a vestigial leftover. What was 156 vestigial organs is down to almost zero after 100 and some odd years because we've learned what they do. And what I said to that professor that day, I'll say to you, sir, I would be very careful about calling what God made junk. Maybe the more humble approach would be, we don't know what that other 95% is doing right now, but give us a little while. So, here is the flashiest presentation I've ever done. I'm going to go whoosh. And what I'm doing is taking stuff out of these two books. This latest one, The Myth of Junk DNA, is powerfully good. Because it talks about all the discoveries made in the last 10 to 15 years that show us what that junk's doing. That really isn't junk at all. So here we go, fast treatment. Evidence that the DNA is probably functional even though it looks like it isn't. Evidence for specific biological functions of the non-protein coding DNA. I want to say something. Remember introns? I told you to remember that. That's those little pieces that are snipped out. You know what evolution said about that? Why would God make a copying machine that has to be edited and reformed into a mature? Those introns are junk. You know what we found out? Introns do all kinds of amazing things. And they're absolutely critical. They're rich in splicing factor recognition sites. They encode a majority of the small RNAs. And we're finding out small RNAs do all kinds of amazing and important things for the body that we knew nothing about 10 years ago. There's information concentrated and specified. There are multiple messages stored in the same sequence of bases. There are spliceosomes and editosomes, codes within codes, dual and overlapping messages. I have to take just a minute. I can't stand it. I can't flash through this. An example in that book is a letter written by a mama during the Revolutionary War to her husband who was in the military. The letter was talking about what's going on the ranch, on the farm. The animals, the kids, the stuff, school. That's what the letter was about. But ladies and gentlemen, if you knew the code, inside the letter was information about where the troops were and how much was stored and where it was stored and how to protect yourself from those enemies. But the letter, when you read it, sounded like a story from home. Right? Would you say it took intelligence to put that together? A code inside a code? I'll tell you what we're learning about DNA. There are codes inside of codes, and there are overlapping codes. Here's what we've learned, class. There's some stretches of DNA. Remember I told you it copies a stretch like this? And then that RNA has to be snipped and edited? Here's what we've learned, class. We've learned that you can snip and edit that to make 1,000 different proteins out of the same stretch. Pardon me for yelling, but it's overwhelming. So what that tells us is the stuff we thought was junk is 10 times more complex than we ever dreamed. There's codes within codes and overlapping messages. There's all kinds of stuff going on in there we're just beginning to uncover. The pseudogenes I mentioned to you, here's what we're learning. Some of them produce functional proteins, some produce RNAs, some produce RNAs. They're doing stuff. They're not just pseudo. And the repetitive, non-productive piece, I'll tell you what we're learning. Those are absolutely critical to the functioning of the DNA. There's lots of files and superfiles and all kinds of stuff. If we received a message from outer space containing just the genetic code with an explanation of how it is used to build proteins, there isn't a human being on earth that would say that didn't come from an intelligent source. But the standard theory in every biochemistry classroom on earth is that that evolved by natural causes. I'm sorry, class. I get off. I can't believe it. Everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things certainly look like they are made, says Michael Behe in his wonderful book, Darwin's Black Box. A loud, clear, piercing cry of design is everywhere you look. So why not just admit that there was a designer? It is by far the most reasonable explanation for the complexity that we see. And that's my lesson for tonight. I have to tell you, when I conclude a lesson like this, I often feel a miserable failure because of the lack of information that I gave you. You feel like you've been fed by a fire hose. But we haven't touched the hem of the garment of the marvelous nature of what God has done. Please be assured, if you go digging into those books and thousands of others, you'll only become more in awe of the creator of this marvelous design. Now, if you'll get your songbooks, We don't wish to close this service without providing an opportunity for someone who's here who may have heard enough about God to become a believer in Him, and even to look further and become a believer in the Bible as the Word of God, which gives us the greatest message man has ever received, and that is that God loves us in spite of our sin. He loved us so much that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. So if you're a believer, we'd hope you'd come forward tonight in a minute as we stand up and say that with your mouth. I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And were you to do that, we'd accept that confession and immerse you in water. Everything's ready right here because that's what Jesus said to do. We hope you'll do that even this night. Come while we stand and as we sing.